Joe Hudson has lived the life of a rebel. He lived in 26 places in 28 years, lived in a van for a year, spent 7 years of his life meditating, and then went on to become a Hollywood director, a venture capitalist, and a philanthropist. Today, he is the highly sought-after executive coach and founder of The Art of Accomplishment. And while his work is widely praised and received in the C-suites of Silicon Valley, the real lesson in his message is not about spreadsheets and stock options. He focuses in on leadership and living as being an act of getting in touch with your authentic self by embracing and understanding the emotions that animate you, by expressing love through setting clear boundaries, and that establishing authentic connections with yourself and others is the real superpower. As Joe says, he is constantly looking at what allows him to be in deeper connection with himself and others.
Hello, and welcome to At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on the world we live in today. At the Podium holds a space for everyone to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I'm thrilled to share the podium with Joe Hudson. Joe Hudson is a sought-after executive coach and the creator of The Art of Accomplishment, an online learning platform for personal development. As a venture capitalist, Joe found that the most rewarding aspect and the part he was the most successful at was the mentorship and coaching of the leadership of his portfolio companies. This insight moved him into his present role as a coach, business consultant, and teacher. He now coaches 12 CEOs and leaders in prominent companies and runs transformative programs for both individuals and businesses. He is practicing a craft that makes big, lasting, and overwhelmingly positive impacts on the lives of the people in his programs and in the companies he works with. Joe, welcome to At the Podium.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm so glad to have you on today. I have so many questions. You have lived what can only be called a non-traditional life. You've lived you lived in 26 places by the time you were 28. Yeah. You lived in a van for a year. You lived on less than $12,000 a year for 7 years. Was that during the time when you were meditating?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. 7 years. I spent most of my time in the room meditating and worrying about money. Probably
like all the same time.
30% worrying about money, 70% of the time meditating. Yeah.
But now you have really stepped into, I would say, a new chapter of your life past that $12,000 a year for 7 years meditating in a room. And you've started a company called The Art of Accomplishment, which is really turning Silicon Valley on its head and really making the venture capitalist world, the tech world, rethink how they approach their business and how they approach leadership within their business. So it's been quite a journey for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's like probably three chapters after the living on almost no money. But yeah, it's been different. I think the only thing I would say about that is I'm not sure if I'm making Silicon Valley think about the world differently. I think it's more of the reality is that Silicon Valley is thinking about the world differently. And if I'm lucky, I help them create the world that they want to live in. The people that I work with anyways, that's more of the reality for me is I facilitate people creating the worlds that they want. And less than deciding what the world is that they should be in.
And why do you think Silicon Valley is thinking about the world differently?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say, so right now in my, like, if I look at all the people who I serve, probably about 50% are Silicon Valley or Austin, that, you know, the Texas Silicon Valley. But but probably the other 50% are all around the world and doing all sorts of different things. But yeah, why does Silicon Valley think about the world differently? I think that it's rewarded here. You're successful if you think about how, like, have a vision of a future that is different than what's being presented to you. I think people are ambitious as well. But I think the other thing that's most important that happens is there's a lot of binary thinking in the world and there's less of it in Silicon Valley, meaning that it's like, either I can be successful or I can be a environmentalist. Nah, you can be both. Or I can be wealthy or spiritually whole. No, I can be both. Like, so the way that they think often here, the way people think is, oh, this is a false binary. How do I get both of the things? You know, whether that's, you know, revenue and doing good, or whether that's being a successful leader and being a leader that empowers people.
You said something that I thought was really interesting that I think highlights what you're describing here. And you said in one of your podcasts, thoughts by their nature are limited and they cannot describe reality. I cannot paint an accurate portrait of the world with one color, and I cannot describe the world accurately with only one function being intellect. To be Yes. able to have a full experience, to describe a full experience of something, I need something besides the intellect.
Yeah.
So is this where your work with the art of accomplishment begins?
For many people, that's the case. You know, is the discovery that there's intelligence beyond the intellect that they can trust in to live their life, right? So most of the people, a big decision comes and they start doing SWOT analysis and they think through what's the good, what's the bad, and then they spin on it and then they beat themselves up for not taking action. Like, this is kind of like the typical thing that people often do. And there's other mechanisms in the body that help us make decisions. In fact, what neurology will tell us is that if I went into your brain and I pulled out the emotional center of your brain, you would stop making decisions. Your IQ would be the same, meaning you might be incredibly intelligent, but it would take you a half an hour to decide what color pen to use. It would take you 4 hours to decide where to have lunch. Your life would absolutely fall apart. And what it tells us is, neurologically speaking, we do not make decisions based on intellect. We use the intellect to try to discover what decision will make us feel what way. So the reality is, it's like, how many decisions have you made to feel like a success? How many decisions did you make to feel to make sure you didn't feel unloved, or to make sure you didn't feel like a failure, or to make sure that you did feel like you were valuable? And that's how we work. We don't work through the intellect. So if you don't understand the emotional system and how to use it the way that you understand the intellectual system and how to use it, then you don't have a competitive advantage. But more importantly, you're far more likely to be miserable.
I think the idea of a non-binary view of the world is encapsulated in your statement. That it isn't just one thing. And I think oftentimes we try to make life, we try to synthesize to one thing, and there's great complexity. And that within the complexity, that's where the magic, the power, the joy, the expansiveness of life and living can be. And I would imagine that's where the expansiveness of leadership is that it's a broader picture than just the intellect. We had a guest on the show last season. Her name is Cassandra Worthy, who talked about, as a leader, as a person in charge of anything, as a person in charge of your own life, you have to deal with the emotional life of the people who work for you. You have to deal with the emotional, three-dimensional people who work for you. Otherwise, you won't be successful in your business or in any of your endeavors.
Yes. The only word there that I would call question to is deal with. But yes, that is part of the interaction of humanity. Yeah. And to understand, for me, the word is connection. So understand how to create connection with yourself and others is a superpower. And so if you think about what I just said, it's like I said, I would I would contend with the word deal with that, because that creates less connection in me to say, oh, I need to deal with that, than it does, I get to play with that. I get to interact with that. I get to. So I'm constantly looking at what allows me to be in deeper connection with myself and others.
Is that the piece that you need beyond the intellect, is the connection? Or
I think there's lots of ways to put it. I would say that the easiest way to put it is you have three brains, basically. You have, and it's the development of humanity is what creates those three brains. So you have the reptilian brain, which is the nervous system, kind of that system. There's the emotional system, which is the mammalian brain. And then there's the prefrontal cortex, which is the human part of the brain. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have transformation, or if you want to be able to really solve or interact with people in a full way, solve problems in a full way, then you need to approach all three levels. So it's not just, let's make it like super easy. How many people have you seen, like, I know I should lose weight, but I don't. I know right. I should quit smoking, but I don't, right?
That would be me. I don't smoke. I want to lose about 15 pounds. And I'm like,
right.
It's okay.
Exactly. So there's that
still fit.
So there's the intellectual understanding that happens. And then that doesn't mean change happens. And that means that the mammalian part of the brain, or the nervous system part of the brain, isn't on board yet. And so for me, it's like, how do you get all three of them aligned and on board?
Is this why we have, this may take us in a different direction, but that's fine. So right, what you're saying is this why, for instance, we can intellectually understand that racism is a bad thing and that misogyny is a bad thing, but we haven't had that penetrate our core as a society to where we no longer countenance someone walking into a church and shooting the parishioners because they're Black, or someone going to a grocery store in New York and opening fire and shooting them because they're Black, or people not paying people the same amount of money because they're women, that we haven't actually had that concept that we all intellectually understand. We haven't had that drop into our, beyond our human brain, but into our reptilian brain, our deep awareness of self.
I think for some, it's not even on the intellectual awareness, right? There's definitely people in our society who have the very strong intellectual understanding inside of themselves, not truth, that one person is better than another person. In fact, I would say that most people walk around thinking that they're better than this person or worse than this person, that their comparative brain is always happening. And occasionally that flows into, I'm better because I'm a man, or I'm better because I'm Black, or I'm better because I'm Chinese, or I'm better because I'm white. So I think that the comparative mind, which is an intellectual function, definitely isn't healed in our society by any stretch. And I think there are also a group of people who understand that racism is bad or sexism is bad, but it hasn't penetrated into, you know, the understanding is intellectual. It's not fully emotional or in the nervous system. And at the same time, I think that if you're trying to shame somebody, like if I have a kid and I shame that child, what I know is that I am strengthening the behavior in that child. So you want a kid to be naughty, just tell them they're naughty all the time and they will grow up naughty, guaranteed. That's how it works. If you shame yourself over being 15 pounds too heavy, you will never lose that 15 pounds for any substantial length of time. Shame implants bad habits. It is like the lock that holds the chains of bad habits in place. Shame someone for being racist, and you will just lock in that bad habit. And so, you know, fighting for power and shaming people, things like that, will only increase the tension in the society. Assuming the vision of, oh, of course I have a right here. Of course my voice is important. Of course I see you equally as I see myself. I have a relationship where I don't see us even as separate. That's where change happens. If you can show up in love for somebody who is in hate for you, that's where change happens. That's where the progress occurs, whether it's in a marriage or whether it's in a society or whether it's in an economy.
But that is making the assumption that both people view each other as equals.
It's just in your heart that matters. If you come to me and you have something to prove, you are going to prove to me that we're equal. You've already proven to me that we're not.
Mm.
But if you show up with me with love in your heart and you see me and there's no separation between us, my worldview of inequality eventually has to collapse. I think the thing that gets confused in that is that to fully love somebody, you have to be boundaried. And so that boundary is an incredibly important part of it as well. So what do I mean there? I mean that if you look at any paragon of love, Mandela, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, a great mother, just like a great mom. Oh, wow. She's a great mom.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of them have really clear boundaries. No, we're not lesser. No, I'm not going to deal with inequality in the law. Like, no, I have very clear boundaries. No, you're not going to eat all the cookies you want. There's a very clear boundary there. And that boundary is actually a facilitator of love. It's not a diminishment of love.
Then how do you handle the continuum? So if we use Martin Luther King as an example, you don't get Martin Luther King without Medgar Evers and Plessy versus Ferguson and the Dred Scott decision and the rebellions that happened during slavery. So there, and maybe I'm misunderstanding your assumption.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you can't have the sort of explosive and the sort of dynamic work of Martin Luther King without all of the hundreds, maybe thousands of years of oppression that happened before that he was pushing against. And perhaps there was a zeitgeist at the time that allowed him to pop through an historical landscape of oppression.
Yeah.
But are you viewing that as an act of love or an act of an assumption of equality between the two parties?
Yeah, I'm speaking only of the internal view of you or me, or I'm saying that I am not going to create any kind of true shift unless I am able to love you as I love myself.
Mm.
To me, it's a very practical notion. Like, just look at any marriage that is in turmoil. Like, the way that they get out of that turmoil is to see each other without judgment.
And is this, now that we've thoroughly confused everybody.
Yeah. I hope we did. Yeah.
is this what the art of accomplishment is? Because you say that people show up thinking they want one thing, and then they actually realize what they need is something else. Maybe we should be talking about how do I see myself in you and value you as I value myself, assuming that I do value myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's a very large part of what we do at Art of Accomplishment is learning to, I call it connect with yourself and others, but I would say love yourself and others would be, and I don't mean that in like, there's a lot of people who can say, oh, I need to love my, I'm literally talking about the visceral feeling of love for yourself. The way that you maybe have a kid or a dog or something where you're like, oh my God, I just like, you can't not love that or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, like that feeling. I'm talking about having that feeling towards yourself. I'm talking about that visceral experience. So I think that's a large part of it. However, what I've noticed is that people can't really have access to that level of love without also access to empowerment. So if you close your eyes for a minute, this is for the people who are listening. If you close your eyes for a minute and you feel, do this experiment at home, feel unconditional love and then feel empowerment, deep empowerment. Like there's nothing, there's nobody who's going to throw you off of who you are. The kind of empowerment of, like there's nothing you even have to prepare for because you know you can show up as you no matter what happens. And you take those two visceral feelings and you'll start noticing they're very similar. And if you put them together, they're actually the thing you're looking for more than either one of them alone. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge part of Art of Accomplishment, which is about helping people find that deep empowerment inside of themselves where they're living their authenticity they're living their truth despite the consequences. And because that's where great things are accomplished. That's where when you finish accomplishing the thing, you feel good instead of you're like, oh, I'm 50 years old. I've got everything that I ever worked for, that I ever wanted, and I'm miserable, right? Which is the story of so many people that I know. Right. This is, oh, wow, I've created something and I'm satisfied as a human. Not satisfied, like I'm not going to do anymore, but like I am content in my world.
Is this the human struggle? Or is it a function, or is it a function of the modern world? Like if we were to go back and sit with, I don't know, George Washington, would he have felt the type of self-actualization that you're talking about? Or would he have felt?
I've only lived in this time frame, right? But I can say that I have interacted with societies more in the indigenous world that don't struggle with this the way that we do. What is my purpose isn't a question that is stirring in them.
I've had this conversation before with people about, is our struggle based upon the sort of stuff that peoples and fills our worlds? But is there within that assumption that, let's say, indigenous people or
some indigenous people that I've interacted with?
Yes.
Yeah. Not all indigenous people. Yeah.
Right. But I've had this conversation before, not in this context, but I wonder, is there a certain level of assumptions that we're making that the nobility of poverty, that when you remove all of the extraneous pieces from your life, which you could potentially argue is an indigenous existence where you're not bogged down with your house note, your car payment, your whatever, that something else emerges that is more profound and deeper for you than just striving. Is that in and of itself an act of inequality?
The way I see it is a little bit different than that. The way I see it is that for a system to be resilient, it needs to have pressure. Meaning that if you want to be in shape, you got to pressure the system every once in a while. You got to work out. If you don't, then the collapse that you will finally hit will be big and sooner. Same with a economic system, that you need tests on the economic system or the collapse that you are going to experience is going to be much bigger. Mm-hmm. So life, there is a kind of a maximum, a healthy amount of resistance that any physical human system needs, probably any ecosystem needs, that tension is an important part of it. To me, the question is, what is that tension in an indigenous society? We have some tensions, their money, notes, they have tensions, lack of medical care. And so what is the right amount of tension in a system to keep it healthy and alive? And I think that's the question that I'd be asking rather than nobility of poverty or, you know, what's the best way to live? I don't really think about it that way at all. I don't think the idea of poverty even exists in the same way of the indigenous people that I'm thinking about, like the ones that I've interacted with. The idea of poverty is incredibly different to them. Right. Which is actually as a question in general, it's like, what does poverty really mean outside of the economic structures? Like, what's mental poverty? You know, and how many religions say that poverty is a great thing? And are they talking about physical poverty, like economic? Are they talking about mental poverty? So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of questions there about what exactly poverty means.
You said something interesting that really struck me. You talk about, it's more of a question.
Yeah.
In how you approach your work and your view of the world, there seems to not be a hierarchy of emotion.
Yeah.
You seem to view emotion as a fuel, as an energy, and that the stop isn't about anger or rage or a feeling of poverty. It's about one's inability to use those feelings for action. Am I understanding that correctly?
It's close. Yeah, that's pretty close. I would say that emotions are always happening. You are having an emotion right now, and you're still having an emotion right now. And there's a slightly different emotion happening right now. Like, we all have emotional states, while we're awake at least, that are constantly flowing through us. Mm. To me, the question is, how constricted is the emotional state and how fluid is the emotional state? Is the thing that creates the most freedom and joy in our life. So I have a saying that says, joy is the matriarch of a family of emotions, and she won't come into a house where her children aren't welcome. And so it's about welcoming all the emotional experiences. So if let's take anger as an emotional experience. Constricted, it could look like this. That's a nice dress. Or it could look like this. I'm not angry. Or it could look like this. You son of a ba 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 ba. I never should have ba 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 ba. Unconstricted anger is determination. It's clarity. And so the question is, how fluid can your emotional responses be? But what most people have been taught is manage your emotional experience, which is to actually constrict it more, which makes the emotions come out sideways. I'm not allowed to get angry, but I'll be passive aggressive. I'm not allowed to be powerful, so I will undermine other people's powerful. I'm not allowed to be sexual, so I'll be perverted. Like, that's... So it is about allowing the fluidity of the emotions so that they can come into alignment with our care.
You talked about that when you began the process of meditation.
Yeah.
That you wanted to manage what the meditation was going to be.
Yeah.
As opposed to just letting the meditation be.
Yeah. So for me, it was like most people who come into meditation, my experience is that it was a way to manage my moods. If I can do this, I can find peace. I can manage my mental and emotional condition. And what I learned was the management of my mental and emotional condition was more the source of the pain than the actual condition itself. That the constriction and the management of it and the repression of it is the thing that was painful, not the emotions themselves. So allowing the emotions fluidly is just creates a tremendous amount of joy. I can be like, there's a lot of enjoyment for me in being sad. There's a lot of enjoyment for me for being angry. There's a lot of enjoyment in all of it when there's no resistance. It's, you know, but that resistance, man, it can make it all very uncomfortable.
Is this the art of accomplishment?
It's part of it, right? If you're going to, so when I talked about decision-making, if you want to make great decisions, which is required to do really cool things in the world, to accomplish what you want in the world, it isn't about making an intellectual decision because you can't. It's about being okay with all your emotional experiences so that you make clear decisions emotionally. So if I make a decision because I am scared to feel this way or I want to feel that way, then the decision is not as solid as one in which I'm happy to feel. I'm happy to make that decision and I'm willing to take the risk of feeling like a failure or feeling unloved for it. I'm willing to do what I want to do, what's important to me in the world, despite the consequences.
So how does one get to the authentic place? Because the work seems to make an assumption that a person has somewhat of an understanding of what really drives them or what really animates them. So how does one get to that authentic place to even be able to receive the message that you're talking about?
It's a great question. So to me, it's like the same way that an oak tree matures. It's more of a trust in evolution in the process than it is a trust in this moment, meaning how do little kids walk? It's like they have a desire. They want to do it. You can see it when they do it for the first time. They get excited. Like there's this thing inside of them that pulls them into themselves. And in that case, it pulls them into an upright walking human. I don't think that ever changes. We're constantly being pulled. And then people have just taught us things or experience has taught us something or trauma has taught us something that interferes with our ability to hear it, to follow it, to listen to it. But it's not like one day you find out your authentic self and then it's done. It's like, no, you find out that you're continually listening to it and it continually develops and you continually evolve. There's no finish line in it. And the more you do it, the better you are at hearing it, the better you are at following it, the more that that happens. And then the easier it is to accomplish things, the easier it is to be happy and joyful. It's like it falls out of that. It's learning to trust it. It's learning. Let me see if I can give you like a real practical example of it. It would be like, I'll give you an example. This is perfect for the thing that your podcast is about. So I was doing international stock lending when I was 23, 24. I had tripled my salary, 3 raises inside of, like, I was making a ton of money. It was like everything that everybody apparently wanted. I was miserable. I said, no, I want a creative life. So I quit. And I'm like, I'm following the creative path. And I had very little money and I did all this stuff. And finally, I'm in Hollywood. I am about to direct a television show. And I'm what they call, like, you do an observing director thing first, and then you do the directing. And as I'm observing, I'm like, holy crap, this is international stock lending. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. There's one guy on top and he's stressed as shit. Everybody is getting paid a lot of money, but they all want a different job than the job that they actually have. The superstars are coming to me, telling me like that a part of their soul is being ripped out from them every day they come to work. I'm like, holy crap. And I was like, wait, so if that's true, then I was running away from one thing into something that I thought I wanted, only to find out I had no idea what I actually wanted. I didn't know. It was just some idea that I had. And I was like, that'll make me happy. And I ran towards it only to find out it was the same thing. And after that moment, I said, oh, you know what? I'm just going to say yes to stuff that feels good in the moment. And that's how I got here. Was just saying yes to, oh, this feels good, until all of a sudden I couldn't say yes anymore because there's too much stuff coming at me. And then I had to start refining. Well, that'll feel a little better than this. And I, you know, constantly moved in that direction instead of having that idea and instead of following that idea. And so to me, that's kind of the answer to your question of, it's like this constant refinement that's occurring in what we do. It's a constantly learning yourself and becoming more self-aware in the process.
I have many thoughts about what you just said. Let me try to enumerate them.
Okay.
Yeah. My first thought is, I don't know if you know anything about me beyond sort of us talking right now, but I had pursued for many years a career as an actor. Very seriously did that. And then I was living in Los Angeles and doing the thing. And I won't say which show that I was working on, but I was working on a show.
Yeah.
And I got to the set, and with these very highly paid actors and directors, and nobody was happy.
Yeah.
Nobody was happy.
Yeah.
And it gave me a crisis. Because I was like, I'm pursuing the thing that nobody wants or that isn't giving the people who have it the joy that you would imagine one would have if you had all the money, access, power, and were ostensibly doing the thing that you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it threw me into somewhat of a crisis in terms of, well, what am I really striving for here? Which made the decision that I ultimately made to pursue a different path in my life not as painful to make, because I saw what was on the other side. Yeah. And no one seemed to be happy there. So I think there is truth in that we have to understand what it is that we're really striving for and what it is that we're really looking for out of any situation. Which then ties back into your conversation about the authentic thing within you that makes you say yes, that makes you want to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing for me in that is that I have met some people in that business who are actually truly happy now and have found a contentment in the work that they do. Mm. And so I don't want to throw the whole industry under the bus, but what it is we think we're going to achieve to make us happy is not. There is no achievement that occurs that you're like, okay, now I'm done, I'm happy.
Right. Well, you have to know, you know, I'll use the acting metaphor again. You have to kind of know what the thing is that's going to give you the piece of the warm blanket that you're looking for. Oftentimes we get caught up in the plot objective and we're not dealing with the super objective. And we're, you know, well, if I get the house, I'm in this zip code and I have this type of car and I went to this type of school, I'm going to be happy. And then you get all those things and it's just thin air.
Yeah.
Lack of a better word. Yeah. The other thing that comes up for me when we talk is the work that you do is within Silicon Valley and with highly performing CEOs. Can both things be true? There seems to be within what you're talking about a slight dissonance between a sort of deep soul and analytical work that one has to do in order to be self-actualized, to understand your authentic desires. And then does it make sense? And maybe it doesn't have to make sense because that's an emotion perhaps, that we turn that around to create more money.
I think you have two questions there. So let me answer them in order. The first one is I see that almost anything that you are confronted with can be a spiritual tool. So you can use parenting as a spiritual tool. You can learn more about yourself and your relationship with the ephemeral through parenting, through marriage, through career, through starting a business. And in fact, there's an advantage, meaning it's easier to get on a pillow and meditate for 10 hours a day and feel happy than it is running a corporation and feel happy. So you get more, and there's more of a real world like thing. It's like you can convince yourself you're happy on a pillow and wouldn't know any better for 20 years. But man, you will know if it works or doesn't work in business or in a marriage, right? It's like your wife yells at you, you still happy? Your business crumbles, you still happy? You know, you lose a contract, you still happy? Like, it's actually like this really great arena in which to understand yourself. More importantly than that, I think that there's something that happens, like part of a lot of businesses is sales. So how do you sell authentically? How do I sell my product to you in a way that creates more connection between us, that creates more connection in me, that creates more connection in you? And when you, instead of thinking of it as binary, you think, oh, I can do both of those two things. What you'll find out is that you are better at sales, as it turns out, and everybody's happier as humans. And probably there's certain things you can't sell. You know, like there's going to be things that you're just like, oh, I can't do that and feel good about myself or feel more connected. So I have found that the inner work only amplifies the business tools. It only makes you more successful, or it allows your success to be long-lived. There's ways to use very shitty tools to dominate in business, but usually it's pretty short-lived. It's usually more like an Enron thing. Yeah, fear can be prevalent in a business for 100 years and the business can sustain, but it will, even in that, you'll see those big businesses decline as fear starts to rule the roost. So I think, like, especially for people who are creating new businesses, it is a spiritual path if you allow it to be, if that's where your focus is. And so your whole day can be a self-reflection and you get to see how it actually works in the world, which is really, really cool. That's the first part of your question. Second part of your question, if you are using, the way I understand it is, if you're using self-awareness to get more money, then is it really self-awareness or is that self-awareness? Yeah. Is it corrupted? What I notice is that people who are deeply successful over the long term, don't do it for the money. Mm-hmm. Money is an avenue. That doesn't mean that they're all good. Like, I know people who are very successful in the long term because they do it to win. Like, that's their modus operandi. It is to win, to be the best. Like, that competitive nature can create very good long-term success. Other ones are like, I want to have a positive influence on the world. I want to build the best product. I want to build something that looks like this, and I think it's cool as shit, so I want to do it. Some vision outside of making money is required, I would say. I don't know any other examples for long-term success. If it's just about making money, then... So money just becomes a tool, like any tool, and it can be aligned. And like any tool, money has its downfalls as it's created today, and I think it always will, because every tool I know has its downfalls. Screwdrivers are great, but they give you blisters. Gold is maybe better than currency, but you got to dig it out of the ground. It's extraction. It hurts the earth. Currency has its issues in the fact that all currency is set up in a way that there's not enough currency to pay off the interest. So there's never enough, so that it creates poverty in the system in which the currency is built. There's all sorts of downsides, but I don't know of any system, anything that doesn't have downsides if you look at it.
It seems like part of it is being honest with what your motives are.
Absolutely. And constantly discovering what the deeper motive is.
Right.
Because there's a lot of people who do it for one reason, to find out, well, I'm just trying to please my dad. I heard something, I don't know if it's true. I heard something like Oprah Winfrey said, no matter who I'm with at the end of the interview, they lean over and they say, how'd I do?
Every person I have interviewed on this platform does that. I've interviewed some great people, and they're always like, was it?
Right. So, yeah. So I, you know, there's a lot of things that motivate us. And I think that's when I talk about the doing the thing despite the consequence. That's the deep level of empowerment, is like, oh, this feels in alignment with me. I'm referring, it's not even to me. It's more like you said, that calling, that the thing that pulls us to walk, the thing that pulls us into loving relationships, that wants that loving relationship. Like that, it's like, it's learning to follow that. And at some point it even becomes, I would say, choiceless, where you realize, oh, if I don't follow that, it's going to suck. Even though it looks pretty right now, even though taking that move looks pretty, I have enough experience to know that if I stop following that thing, it always hurts. So I'll do the short-term hard thing because I know that I don't really have a choice anymore.
You say, Joe, that you don't do a ton of advertising for your business, and that your best billboards are the people who have gone through your program. And you say that you want people walking around talking about their lives pre-transition, before they met you, and their lives post having worked with you. Yeah. I think Jim Collins calls it the inflection point, or the point of transition, in his book, The Great. What were you like before your inflection point?
Well, first of all, I don't care if people use my name when they discuss their transformation, but I do really want people discussing their transformation, because most people I notice don't think it's possible. Mm. And so just more people talking about their transformation, I think, is incredibly useful. I just want to clarify that part. For me, what was I like? I was all fucked up, man. I was born, I had an alcoholic, emotionally abusive dad who just passed, and I loved dearly. And he didn't particularly change either, by the way. And I was very privileged in some ways, in the fact that, like, I had school and access to safety, and I had economic opportunities. But like right before I started college, all of a sudden I realized I had to pay for it myself. Nobody had that all of it had been drunk away or whatnot, right? So all sorts of interesting things. But so I was a mess. By the time I was 20, I was doing anything I could not to feel. I was trying to push all my emotions down. I was drinking too much. I was not able to have any intimacy. I wasn't able to connect with myself. I blamed other people. I basically did anything I could not to feel. By the time I was 24 or 25, I hadn't cried in 15 years. I didn't know how to anymore. I was angry consistently. I lost my temper all the time. It was brutal. That's the way it was. That's how I was before the transition. I there was I didn't even understand what joy was. I thought I knew what joy was, but from the perspective I am in now, it's like I had no understanding what joy or bliss or peace felt like.
So then what led you to move past that? Because most people just throw in the towel. That's it.
There's a lot of good fortune in it. You know, my role in the family was the rebel. So I was the one that was saying, hey, there's something wrong here. And so whereas my sister was kind of the deeper, making sure everybody felt okay. Like she was more in the caretaker role. And so I think the rebel role has pluses and minuses. The minuses is you're more likely to be the addict. You're more likely to run your life off of a cliff and not look like together in a societal. But it also is the one that's more likely to say, fuck this, I'm going to find a new way. So I was fortunate that way. I was fortunate also in the way that I was always taken by parables and religion. Like I was just always taken by that. And so in college, I started to really dig into religion, but it was all intellectual. So it wasn't doing me any good. Like, it was like, I could tell you every, you know, parable in the Bible and I could tell you all the Taoist stories of Chuangzi, not all of them, but tons of them. And I could tell you about Confucianism, but it didn't, you know, it hadn't made any change in my life, but it was nice that I thought about that. Like I was interested in that. And I was also lucky as a child of an alcoholic, I had to be able to be really good at understanding people, because if I didn't, it was destructive. If I didn't know how my dad was feeling when he walked in the door, that's damage. You have to know when to avoid. And so those were the three things that I had for tool set, was that like understanding people, therefore I could translate it to myself. And having a desire and an openness to that there might be a different way of doing it. And then the next big fortunate thing that happened to me was my wife was also in, you know, brought up in a pretty atrocious situation. And she had discovered therapy. And so when we got engaged, she was like, we're doing therapy. We're doing a silent retreat. We're traveling in third world country for 6 months with like almost nothing. And if we can do those things, then we can get married. And so there was a lot of self-exploration in all of those things. And that was the first time that I was like, oh, now I'm not thinking about it. I'm practicing it. And then change started happening. And then I was like hooked. I was like, whatever that is, I want more of that. I can shift my life into something just a little bit more positive. I can learn to not be in turmoil a little bit less, you know, like, and then I was like hooked. I'm like, whatever this is, I want it. And I just dedicated my entire life to it. Yeah.
So Joe, you have built this really amazing and powerful and impactful platform.
Yeah. Been very fortunate that way.
How do you view it as using your voice, this platform for good in the broader sense of the word and for the world or for your own?
Yeah. Life? I used to think about scaling and having positive impact. And this is one of those places where there's confusion for a while. And then there was just like this identity of hubris in it. You know, like, who am I to tell an oak tree which way to grow? Like, I have more wisdom than this situation, or who am I to dictate what would be a better world? So I follow something a little bit different. What I follow is my enjoyment. I follow, what do I want to do? What gives me joy? What gives me joy is watching people blossom and shine and grow. And what gives me joy is watching companies become more effective and unhinged and more human with one another. So I just keep on doing the stuff that I enjoy. There is some part of me that likes to grow a business, you know, where I'm like, oh, cool. Like, we could do this and like, let's look at it differently. And can we like, and that's really fun. And it's always secondary to my enjoyment. So for me, there's no doing good for the world is like, if I'm in alignment, I can't conceive of it not being good for the world. Mm-hmm. And the more I'm in alignment, if I observe from the outside, the more benefit there is for others. And, you know, I love this metaphor of a caterpillar. Like in some part of a caterpillar's life, its job is to consume a tremendous amount. And then there's like this row of cells that show up on its spine they're called imaginal cells. And then they dictate the change into a butterfly. So we as humans like to go, oh, so much consumption, that's wrong. But what if that consumption is necessary for the butterfly? We also like to say, oh, the butterfly is the more beautiful thing than the caterpillar. Is it though? So for me, it's I'm not smart enough to realize what the long-term plan is. And all I can do is say, oh, if I get to serve others, I get to enjoy myself, and I get to continually be in wonder of the intelligence that other people manifest as they go through their own transitions. And I don't need anything else.
Mm.
Yeah.
Joe, thank you so much for sitting with me today. I really appreciate your thoughts and your wisdom and your huge heart.
Thanks. It's been a total pleasure. And I appreciate you being in that hot, hot place doing this work.
I've like, I'm sweating. I could see my neck sweat. I was like, oh my gosh. But listen, I'm good with it, man. I'm totally for those awesome. Of you who are watching and listening, remember, we all have a voice. Use yours wisely. Bye, everyone. Thank you, Joe.